Hello. So today we have a lecture five on the spectroscopy course. And today we are going to talk about gas phase spectroscopy. Okay. Here we go. Okay, so of course the gas phase spectroscopy is very important in many respects, but there is additional motivation comes from the fact that, in fact, quite many analytical methods in gas phase are based on spectroscopy and mostly infrared spectroscopy. And in Finland, even we have quite many companies who have products which are based on spectroscopy. So there's there are several companies who use advanced spectroscopy knowledge to develop these instruments. And in the end of this lecture, I will show you some examples of these products and companies. So that is additional motivation. There is a need for expertise in gas phase spectroscopy from the industrial point of view, but of course gas phase spectroscopy is very fundamental issue. And the nice thing about gas phase spectroscopy is that there is the spectra are very sharp, so we have sharp lines and there is no there are minimized interactions between molecules, so when you go to liquid phase or solid phase the bands get broad and blurred, but in gas phase we have nice sharp lines which allow high resolution spectroscopy and a very detailed understanding of the energy level structure. So there's of course many motivations to do this. So we have today we are going to go through quite many formulas and there is no time to go in very detail in all the formulas, but you can look back the video and look, check from the book and go through yourself as well. Try to get familiarize yourself with these equations. So gas phase has additional feature that we have rotational spectroscopy because molecules can rotate freely in gas, but when you go to solid or liquid phase, they stop rotating freely anymore. And basically, there are some exceptions, but anyway, rotational spectroscopy concerns gas phase. And before we go here, I would like to say that in all of these topics now on the lectures, it is always about a couple of main things. It is about energy level structure. So because we probe energy level, different kind of energy levels. So first of all, we need to understand what is the energy level structure. And that for that, we use quantum mechanics and we usually have some kind of model system for which we solve the Schrödinger equation. And then that gives us the energy level structure. So we are not going to do this derivation of these energy level structures or solving Schrödinger equation, but we just always have the result. So I show the result, and that is the first point is to understand what kind of energy levels we have, what is the expression for energy levels. And there we always have quantum numbers. So that's the first point. The second point is that we have selection rules. And selection rules tell us which transitions between these energy levels are allowed. And once we know these two things, we can understand how the spectra are formed. So it is always about this. Okay, so keep this in mind. First, we start with rotational spectroscopy, and that concerns Hollas chapter 5. And it is really about molecules rotating. And this first picture shows you as an example of water molecule, what kind of rotational motions we have. We can divide any rotational motions to basically rotation around three principal axes. So we can assign three principal axes and think about rotation around those axes. And then any rotational motion is a combination of these. So basically, in order to fully describe this rotational motion, we need three axes. Okay. So, of course, the central concept here is moment of inertia. If you think classical, you take any object, you throw it in the air, it rotates. And depending on the object, it rotates fast or slow. And the key property there is moment of inertia. And we have formula for moment of inertia. So here, the symbol is I. And in this formula, we refer to some axis. And this is moment of inertia about any axis. So we have defined one axis, for example, one of those which I showed you for water molecule. And then we can calculate the moment of inertia with respect to that axis, which should go through center of gravity. So, and that is the sum of masses, m, all masses, times the distance of the mass from the axis squared. So it's quite simple. You just calculate all the atoms, and you calculate the distance from the axis and square, and then multiply with mass and sum over all atoms. And then you get the moment of inertia. And here, we have axis here, so we should, if we have atom here, so it's really the closest distance to the axis, which is r, and then we have mass. Okay, and you know that, for example, from this skater, you know that if the skater has hands open, she rotates slowly, but if she pulls the hands in, she starts to rotate faster. So what she does, she changes the moment of inertia. So R changes and then starts to rotate faster. So of course, the higher the moment of inertia, the slower the rotational motion. And that now tells us that the rotational motion, the frequency or speed of the rotational motion is related to the structure. So this is also then a way to investigate the structures of molecules. Okay, so that is basically a basis for going then into rotational spectra. And we start from simple systems. So diatomic or linear polyatomic molecules, both can be handled with the same formula. So basically, diatomic molecule mass is M1 and M2. And we are now interested in understanding what are the transition frequencies or transition wave numbers. Remember, these are always related with the Planck constant and speed of light. We have these formulas that energy is h nu or h c nu bar or h c per lambda. So this is something to try to remember. So, and as I told you, first we have to understand the energy level structure. So what are the rotational energy levels? And this is expression for a rigid rotor. So this rotor is just the two masses combined with a stick. So it's a rigid rotor. And this is fairly simple. Now this is now expression for rotational energy levels. And this expression is now in joules. So it is free energy. And what we have there is a bunch of constants. And then we have the moment of inertia downstairs. And then we have J times J plus one in parentheses. So J here is the quantum number. And how did we get this? So this equation is obtained by solving Schrödinger equation for a rigid rod. We don't do it here, but you just should take my word that you define your system as a rigid rotor and you solve the Schrödinger equation, and this is what you get. So this is a remarkably simple expression. And here the J is so-called rotational quantum number. So this tells us that, nice, if I now know one parameter for my molecule, which is the moment of inertia, I can calculate the energy level. This is simple, this is very nice. So how to calculate moment of inertia? So of course, for complex systems, we should follow this formula that I showed, but for a simple system like this diatomic molecule, we can calculate with this simple formula that it is mu times r squared, where mu is a reduced mass, according to this formula, where you just need the two masses, and then the distance between them. So this is a bond distance. So that tells you that if you know your molecule's structure, basically the bond distance, you can calculate the energy, rotational energy levels. That is very nice. Now, in this spectroscopy course, we are going to use so-called term values. So this is a nice way to write these energy levels. So for example, here we use this function F. So this is now a function which gives us energy levels, rotational energy levels. And then we have argument J. So it is as a function of rotational quantum number. So this is nothing more than simply writing this equation for energy levels as a function of quantum number. But it is it's a notation. And for each different spectroscopy, we have different symbol for these term values. And then it's a way how do we describe it. So, but now we go away from Joules because it's not very handy. It is very small quantity in Joules, but we go to frequency. So that is now tells us the frequency of rotation, how many rotations per second. And that is something we use in spectroscopy. So in terms of frequency, what we do is that we take the rotational energy level in Joules and divide by Planck constant. And then we get these energy levels in terms of frequency, so one per second. And then expression is otherwise the same, but we divide by Planck constant. And then now we make another abbreviation. We introduce this constant B. So we put all these constants and the moment of inertia into B. So it looks very simple. So we have just B constant times J plus one in parentheses. And that is called, we call this rotational constant. So this is a very handy way of telling this. So basically you calculate your rotational constant and then you can calculate all your rotational levels with this formula. Very often we also use Weyl number. So for example, in infraspectroscopy, we use Weyl number. And then we have exactly the same, but we just divide the energy in joules with hc. And then in this expression, then we have now the rotational energy levels as a function in terms of Weyl number. So this gives a result with the unit one per meter. So how many waves per meter? Okay. So now you can calculate the energy levels. So first task is now done, and it looks like this. So if you plug in the quantum number zero, so we start from zero, then you see that the first energy level is zero. Okay, J zero is here. Then we put J is one. So what we get is one plus one, it's two. This is one, so it's 2B. So J is one level is at the energy of 2B. And the next one, we plug in two. So we get three from here and two from here. So it's six, it's 6B. So next one is 6B and so on. And now you can calculate all the rotation energy levels. And you see that what happens is that they diverge. So the spacing between levels, it increases. right? Good.
Quick question about the
yes.
B. So yeah. It's B is basically, it changes according to this, what we are studying, quickness of the number, because B has the speed of light lower.
Yes, yes. So although here I give the same symbol, so it's just the, it is, it just depends on whether you want to express your B in wave numbers, then you use this formula, okay? And then your energy levels will be given as wave numbers. So the unit will be wave number. But if instead you would like them to be expressed in terms of frequency, then you use this formula. And then you have, of course, the unit will be 1 per second. So it's something like 10 to 10 or 10 to 9. And the other one is 1 per meter. So it's a big difference. But or if you want to express it in terms of energy, you just use the energy, the first formula. So, but in all cases, we just talk about B, rotational constant. But it, one should just be clear about in what units you are using. All of them are equivalent in energy sense. Okay, so next task was to understand the selection rules. And now, first we talk about energy rules in absorption or emission. And I remind you that how to know the selection rules is that in principle, we have to calculate the transition moment. And you remember the transition moment is an integral over this function where we have the initial state wave function, final state wave function, and the dipole operator in between them. When you calculate this, another wave functions are rotational wave functions. Okay, so and those of you who are taking the symmetry course know that by just knowing the symmetry properties of these functions, we can deduce what are the selection rules, what is non-zero. So also this is something we don't do here, but it's good for you to know that we basically have to investigate this integral, the transition moment, and from there try to understand what conditions need to be fulfilled so that the integral is non-zero. And here we have the conditions. We have basically three selection rules. Now, first, the molecule must have a permanent dipole moment. That's the first requirement. And this is, we can understand this intuitively. Because we are interested in interaction of oscillating electric field. And interaction of oscillating electric field with dipole. Now, when the electric field oscillates, the dipole should change in time so that it resonantly follows this oscillating electric field. And this happens when electric dipole rotates. It rotates and the rotation frequency matches the oscillating electric field, then we have this oscillating dipole. If it was fixed in space, the fixed dipole doesn't follow this oscillating electric field, but the rotating dipole, it does. That's why we must have a permanent dipole moment. If you don't have a dipole moment, then there's no dipole which can couple to this oscillating electric field. Second, is delta J is plus minus one. So the rotational quantum number can change only by one unit. This is a remarkable simplification to the spectrum compared to if you have lots of states and you would have all kinds of transitions, but delta J can change only by one unit. And this we can also understand intuitively because J is a quantum number associated with angular momentum. So when system rotates, it has angular momentum. Now, you know from the conservation laws that angular momentum must be preserved. And in this interaction in absorption or emission, photon has also angular momentum. And when the photon is absorbed, it gives its angular momentum to the molecule. Or if it's emitted, it takes away angular momentum. But it can only take one unit of angular momentum. And that's why we can change the J by one unit only. The third condition, now we have a new quantum number, mj, which we did not have in the formula, but there is this quantum number. It was not in the formula because the energy doesn't depend on this, but the wave functions, we have different wave functions. So we have j quantum number and we have mj quantum number. And this is the same as for atomic orbitals. We have this L and ML quantum number. So mj quantum number takes values for j from minus j to plus j in single units. For j is zero, we have no, mj can only take zero. But for j is one, mj can take minus one, zero, and one. So there are three states. Energy doesn't depend on them, but selection rules we have. So delta mj must change by zero or plus minus one. And this is important only when the molecule is in an electromagnetic field. So most of the time, you just basically the first two are important. Delta J plus minus one and the permanent dipole moment. So now we have selection rules, we have the levels, and we can start to figure out what transitions are possible. We have this notation here. Delta J is J prime minus J prime prime. And here, so we have a convention in spectroscopy that prime means upper state and prime prime means lower state. Okay, upper state J minus lower state J. Okay. And now when we know this delta J is plus minus one, we can calculate transition wave. And this is now very important. It is very important now to understand that when we see a peak in the spectrum, it doesn't correspond directly to single level, but it's a difference between two levels. So it's a transition between two levels. What we observe is always difference between two levels. So when we calculate the transition wave number or transition frequency, it is difference between two levels. Okay, upper minus lower. So, and then, so what we have to do in order to calculate the transition frequency, where do we see the peak in the spectrum, is f j plus one minus f j. Okay, and this is because this corresponds to the selection rule delta j is plus minus one. So you take the expression for f j plus one, write it, and minus f j. And when you do this calculation, you observe that it is 2b j plus one. So what do you expect to see in the spectrum based on this point? What kind of spectrum are you expecting? Any ideas? How will the spectrum will look like? Let me start from a simple. So let's assume that all your molecules are on the ground state. J is zero state. So how many peaks we should see in the spectrum? Yes, only one peak. But rotational energy levels are very small compared to average thermal energy. So in room temperature, very many J levels are populated. So we have molecules J0, J1, J2, J3, J4. And then that means that we will have many peaks. But what is the space in between peaks? If I take one peak and next peak, what is the space in between? Yes. And what is the difference between if you plug here zero and one, you see the difference 2b. So you should see spectrum with many peak equidistant peaks. And if you calculate the distance between two peaks, the difference is 2b. So that is how the spectrum should look like. Okay, so example, carbon monoxide. Here are the levels and transitions. So on the left, it is plotted the energy levels. And now your unit here is wave number. So Fj in terms of centimeter to minus one. Now be very careful here. Our convention is such that for wave number, we use centimeters to minus one. But when you do calculations, if you convert, you use SI units, and there you have to use meter to minus one. So remember always to convert to between meter and centimeter.
Why don't we use
it's handy. I mean, we have nice units, right? For example, from 0 to 200. So it's kind of convenient. It's they are conventions. People have made units which give nice numbers from 1 to 10 to 100s and not 10,000, 100,000. So it's easier. It's just like that. Yeah. So we use centimeters to minus one. So and arrows are the transitions, and here are the possible transitions. And this it's like this because we have delta chase plus one, and these are all absorptions. And here is the this column is a J. So J goes from 0 to 14. And then we have some other factors. I will tell about them soon. So the next factor and next factor are about the degeneracy. And then here, the last column is the transition wave number in terms of centimeters. So we see the first peak should be at 3.84, 7.69, 11, blah, 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 up to 50 and so on. Okay, so this is what we expect. Transitions, and this is how the spectrum, this is part of the spectrum. So this is a measured spectrum, and we see nice peaks about equidistant. They are not exactly equidistant, but we come to that next. So now you understand rotational spectra, okay? Where does it come from? And now intensities, of course, I mean, the spectrum overall has shape. So we have weak peaks and then stronger maximum, and then it weakens again. So what determines these intensities? For intensities, we have two factors. The first one is transition moment, or square of the transition moment. So spectroscopic transition is proportional to the square of the transition moment. But it turns out that this transition moment changes quite little with J. So transition moment from 0 to 1 is almost the same as transition moment for 1 to 2. And 2 to 3. So it's not very strongly varying. So we can approximate this as constant, but what is important is the population. So of course, you know from statistical mechanics or thermodynamics that we have just a certain population of the states, and higher we go in energy compared to the available energy, which is the thermal energy, the population goes down. So that means that for higher transitions, necessarily intensity goes down. And now this expression is the population of the lower state. So this N is population. What proportion of molecules are on state J? And in this expression, we use this division by N0. So that is compared to the ground state, lowest state. So, and in this expression, I start from this exponential here. So this should be familiar to you. So exponent to minus E per KT. So that is, and E is a rotational energy. So that is exponentially decaying function in terms of energy. So higher we go in energy, the lower the population. This is a thermodynamics. But the first factor is degeneracy factor, UJ plus one. And that comes from this MJ quantum number. So it is how many states we have at this energy. and so we have for J is 1, 0, we have only one state. So we have J is 0 and MJ is 0. But for J is 1, we have 3 states with equal energy, MJ, is minus 1, 0, and 1 for 3 states. And for J is 2, we have 5 states. minus 2, minus 1, 0, 1, 2. And you see that the number of states is 2j plus 1. So here it's 1, here it's 3, 2j plus 1, here it's 5, again 2j plus 1. So the higher we go, more states we have. And that is this linear function here. So the more states, more population. So we have two competing functions. We have degeneracy, which increases the population linearly, but we have exponential function, which decreases exponentially. Overall, it leads to population, which looks like something like this. So low states, not too many, then more, and then we have maximum, and then it decays. Okay? So this is the overall population, and that is the gives us the profile. Intensities follow closely this population function. And it is written here, the degeneracy issue. Okay, so because the transition moment doesn't change so strongly, then this population is what we see in the total spectrum. We'll look like something like this. There will be peaks and stronger peaks, and one peak is maximum, and then that is how the spectrum should look like. Interestingly, you see that if you measure the spectrum, you actually can determine the temperature from the overall shape. If you can actually determine where the population maximum is by taking the differential with respect to temperature, and this is expressed. So if you can simply look where is the population maximum, and then from there you can directly calculate the temperature. So that is how it looks like. This is method here by us, and that is how the spectrum looks. And now you understand everything in the spectrum. You understand what are the transitions, why the shape is like that. Okay. So okay, that was simple. So if that was the whole truth, we would have quite simple understanding of the rotational spectrum. But as always, this is not the whole truth. But we have a effect which makes some changes in the spectrum, and this is centrifugal distortion. So this is again simple to understand intuitively. If you take two masses and which are connected by a spring, and you throw it, it has a certain length. And if you throw it in the air and it starts to rotate, what is going to happen to this distance between the balls? If it rotates faster and faster, what happens to the spring?
It's longer.
Yeah, it's stretchy. It's like if you're in a carousel, there is a force which tries to kick you out. So when the object rotates faster, it tends to stretch. If it stretches, it means that equilibrium distance changes, increase. Now, what happens to the moment of inertia?
Increase.
So that means that moment of inertia is not anymore constant. So it means that for higher rotational states, moment of inertia increases, and that means that it tends to decrease the spacing between the levels. So there will be change in the spectrum. It is not exactly equidistance, but for higher J states, the distance tends to get smaller. So, and that is an effect we have to take into account. So then we have to go we have to make a correction to the rigid rotor approximation. And this correction can be done simply by introducing so-called centrifugal distortion constant, which means that we just assign a second parameter, which is here D, which is taken into account here, so that the expression for energy levels is now a bit more complicated. We have a new term here. And in fact, this expression again can be obtained from a rigorous theory, but the usage of this equation is important here. So originally we had this B times J times J plus one in parentheses, but now we introduce correction term where we have B, which is centrifugal distortion constant, and J squared times J plus one squared in parentheses. So this is kind of like a series expansion, the first order term and second order term. And because we have minus here, and if D is positive number, that means that the energy level is a little bit lower energy than without this term. And it increases like J squared. So if D is small parameter, for low J states, this is very small. But when J gets higher, because this increases faster than the first term, for higher levels, it starts to play a role. So that it becomes more important for higher J levels. And now we can take this simply into account by, again, calculating the transition wave numbers, same way as before, F J plus one minus F J, but now we insert this new formula. And you can do this as a practice, and you calculate this, and then the result is here. So it's again, two terms, the first one is the same as before, but we have a correction term where we have four times D and J plus one is to the third power. So in the beginning, it's very small, but it starts to rise quickly when the J goes up. Okay, so, so that is then, if you use this expression, you really get very accurate results compared to experiment. Now we have a second issue, and that is the fact that if we talk about pure rotational states, pure rotational spectroscopy, normally or mostly we deal with the molecules which are on the ground vibrational state. But as we come later to vibrational rotational spectroscopy, we can have also probe states. We can simultaneously excite vibrational states, or sometimes your molecule can be excited vibrationally already thermal. So then we have to think about what effect does it have if the vibrational state changes. Now, again, let's take intuition. So if we have a molecule on the ground state, it has a certain equilibrium distance. But if I start to stretch it more strongly, so it vibrates at higher energy level, the equilibrium distance on average gets larger. Okay? So it means that the equilibrium distance for higher vibrational state is higher than for the ground state. So again, moment of inertia changes. And this is not, in fact, this is not straightforward, because unharmonicity of your potential is important here. So this is here's a potential energy surface or curve for diatomic molecule. So it describes potential energy as a function of distance between atoms. And as usual, we have equilibrium distance, which is here at the minimum. But if we stretch, potential energy increases strongly, but in the end, it goes to zero change when the molecule dissociates. And when we squeeze the atoms together, we get very strong repulsion. And that's why the term is like this. And the arrow here, the purple arrow, kind of shows the trend, what happens to average or basically the quantum mechanical expectation value of the distance between atoms. Because the potential looks like this, the vibrational wave function will be more localized for higher vibrational states, and the average distance gets higher. If we would have harmonic oscillator, which is symmetrical, it would in principle not change. Because even if you go to higher states, the average distance would be always the same. But because of the unharmonicity, the equilibrium distance gets larger for higher states. Okay. So we need to consider this by taking into account the V dependence of J. So V is a vibrational quantum. So that tells what is the vibrational state. And we take this into account by just giving a sub-index here for our term value, where V tells us for which vibrational state this rotational energy level is referred to. Because what we have now is that I first draw here vibrational energy levels. So this is the V0. And then let's say that we have V is one here. Okay. And for each vibrational state, we have all the possible rotational states. So we have V0, J0, but then we have J is one, J is two, and so on. So these rotational levels are for the molecule on the ground vibrational state. But then we also have the same kind of stack of rotational levels for this state. So V is one, J is zero, and then we have similar kind of stack of rotational states for vibrationally excited state. And then we have V is two, and again we have all the rotational states. For each vibrational state, we have all the rotational states. And the energy level spacing is slightly different for each vibrational state because the equilibrium distance is slightly different. It's not much, but a little bit. So our expression is same as before, but we have different B and D for each vibrational state. It is simply like this. And the difference is not large, it's small, maybe about 1% or so. But you can see this in the spectrum. And the transition wave number for frequency, same expression as before, but now we just have different B and D for each vibration state. Okay, then I show a couple of useful formulas. So we should then basically somehow determine all these parameters for each vibrational state. But it turns out that if you determine them for two states, you can approximate with this formula all the states. So basically, VV, so rotational constant for any state, vibrational state, can be obtained from this formula where we have two parameters. We have VE, one parameter, and alpha, and this is vibrational quantum. So if you know these two parameters, you can calculate the state. And in order to know two parameters, you have to have two formulas. So basically two equations. So you need to have two transitions from which you can calculate these parameters. And the point of BE is that if I take this potential curve, you remember that the true equilibrium distance, what we have experimented, is not this bottom here, but because we have zero point energy and our vibrational wave function is here. And it is the expectation value of this thing where we have R0, we call it R0.
So this is V0. But this is kind of classical turning point here. And here, we call this distance RE. It's not the same as this. It's close, but not exactly.
And that is the philosophy that this BE refers to this point here. That's the difference. So, and this alpha is so-called vibration rotation interaction constant. So if you measure two transitions, different transitions, where we have two different vibrational states, and you fit this two transitions to this formula, you can calculate BE and alpha, and then you can calculate all the BEs. Okay, so now we discussed transitions in absorption or emission. But we can also observe rotations in Raman spectroscopy. And Raman spectroscopy is a technique where we have scattering of light, not absorption or emission, but scattering. And that means that in terms of photon mixture, we have molecule, and we have our photon coming in, and it scatters from the molecule, and it can scatter so that no energy is exchanged. So the photon has the same wavelength as original photon. I put here lambda laser, but use a laser. But we can have inelastic scattering where photon and molecule exchange energy. So the scattered photon will have, in this case, longer wavelength than the excitation wavelength, or it can have shorter, so it changes. What happens here is that photon gives energy to the molecule and scatters, and then it necessarily changes its wavelength or energy. And so energy remains in the molecule, or molecule gives energy to the photon. So in this case, the energy increases for the photon, or wavelength decreases. So, and that is inelastic scattering. Okay. Now, in terms of energy level diagram, the process looks like this. We can have three different kind of processes in Raman scattering: Rayleigh, anti-Stokes, and Stokes. And we start from the Rayleigh. And now, in this diagram, we have a, on the lower state, we have a rotational states, 0, 1, and 2. Of course, there are more, but for simplicity, we only put 3. And upstairs here, we can have some state. That doesn't matter what these states are. There actually doesn't have to be any real states, because the interaction with the molecule is just during extremely brief time. So, but anyway, upgoing arrow is the photon which comes to the molecule and collides with the molecule, and the scattering is described with the downgoing arrow. So this happens in basically one event, up and down. So photon in, photon out. And when the photon comes to the same level as the where we started, it is elastic scattering, no energy exchange. And we call this Rayleigh scattering. This second pair of arrows signifies that we can also, starting level can also be, for example, J2. So we go up and we come down, and no change. No change in the quantum state of the molecule, and this is Rayleigh scattering. So in effect, what happens is photon changes its direction, scatters off, but the wavelength is the same. This is where we discussed on the first lecture about the blue sky. So that is Rayleigh scattering. But then we have Stokes. So in Stokes scattering, we start here from the zero, photon comes in, and the second one is scattered. But the scattered photon ends up J2 at J2 level. So that means that it leaves molecule excited. So energy is exchanged from the photon to molecule. And in effect, it corresponds to the transition from zero to two. Molecule makes transition from zero to two because the two photons are involved, in and out, and molecule takes energy from the photon. But the photon loses energy, so it shifts its energy or wavelength. Or we can have anti-Stokes, we start from a J2 and we come down to J0. In this case, molecule changes from J2 to J0, and it is signified with this arrow. So in effect, this is anti-Stokes. Molecule gives out energy to the photon. And again, photon energy or wavelength shifts. So when this happens, what do we expect to see in the spectrum? If I take narrow laser beam, shine it to the sample, I should see, when I record the spectrum of scattered light, I should see peak exactly at the same wavelength as the excitation light, but I should also see a peak at low energy or longer wavelength, and peak at the high energy or shorter wavelength. So in principle, I expect to see like this. So let's say that the lambda excitation, this is my excitation wavelength, let it be 500 nanometers. Then in my spectrum, I should see a peak at 500 nanometers, but I should see another peak here. It is 500 plus delta nanometers, and another peak here, 500 minus delta nanometers. Right. And this is one transition. If I have many transitions, I should see many peaks on both sides. And this spectrum is the Raman spectrum and Stokes Raman spectrum, and this is anti-Stokes Raman spectrum. Okay. So this is how it looks like. So what we do is that we plot. Usually we don't plot the wavelength, but we convert wavelength to so-called Raman shift. And that is basically taking the assigning the Rayleigh peak where it is excitation peak, and then subtracting this Rayleigh peak wavelength from the scattered photon wavelength and converting to wave number. So basically, first subtract the excitation wavelength, and then you get in wavelength scale, but then convert it to wave numbers by taking the inverse. And then what you get is this kind of scale where the Rayleigh peak is as zero, right? Because it was excitated. And then we have a Stokes side and anti-Stokes side. And this now in wave numbers. And you see that the positions of the Stokes peaks and anti-Stokes peaks are exactly the same in absolute scale, because they refer to the same states, right? The difference is the same. So this is how the Raman spectrum should look like. And it turns out that the Rayleigh scattering is much, much, much stronger than Raman. So roughly, it's about 3 orders of magnitude stronger than Raman spectrum. So we should see very strong peak and tiny peaks at the Raman. So, and then we need good spectroscopic methods to attenuate the Rayleigh peak and see the Raman peak. So we have filtering and spectroscopic techniques. Okay, so let's see how this now looks in rotational Raman spectroscopy. It turns out that the selection rule is delta J 0 or plus minus 2. And why is this? How can we justify this? It's because in scattering, we have two photons. And two photons can give 2 units of momentum, angular momentum, or take 2 units of angular momentum. And that's why the delta J plus minus 2, or one can take and one can give, and then it's altogether 0. Because it's a two photon process. 2 units of angular momentum, 0 plus minus 2. That means that the transitions, and now I'm just drawing here
what happens to molecule? I don't draw anymore the diagram with the incoming and outgoing photon, but what happens to the molecule? On the Stokes side, we have transitions 0 to 2, 1 to 3, 2 to 4. So we go up 2 units. Or in anti-Stokes, we have 7 to 5, 6 to 4, blah, 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 down to 2 to 0. Right. So energy levels are exactly the same as with absorption or emission, but transitions are delta J is 2. Or we can have delta J is 0, and then we have this. It's basically the Rayleigh line. There is an additional condition that polarizability should be anisotropic. What does it mean? It means that we come later to this, so I don't go much details here, but it comes from classical thing. So what happens is that what we need again is that in this process, we need to generate oscillating dipole. And in scattering, how we generate oscillating dipole is that we have the molecule, and now we have to think in terms of electromagnetic field. So electromagnetic field, it distorts the electron cloud. It distorts the electron cloud, and when it distorts the electron cloud, electronic cloud, we generate induced dipole in the molecule. And when the molecule rotates, if this cloud distortion is not same in every direction, but it depends on the direction of the molecule with respect to field, then the induced dipole will change according to the how the molecule is oriented. And then when the molecule rotates, this induced dipole, it oscillates. Right? You see, for example, if we have this diatomic molecule, let's put the electron cloud. So let's say that my field is now in this direction. So we induce a small dipole in this direction. But now when the molecule rotates, so now it's like this. Now again, if the field direction is the same, we again generate induced dipole. But for sure, in this direction, the induced dipole, it's not the same as here because it's very different. It's not the same to distort the electron cloud in this direction than in this direction. So that means that when my field oscillates, I get this induced dipole, it oscillates. But when the molecule rotates, this induced dipole magnitude changes. So we have this oscillating induced dipole and it changes. And this is anisotropic. So the polarizability is not the same in all directions, and that is a second requirement. Because if it was the same in all directions, it would not change in the rotation. And then we would not have this oscillation of this induced type. Okay. So again, just similarly as for absorption emission, we get transitions. And now the transition is again we calculate by taking the term value difference, but now fj plus 2 minus fj because of the selection rule, and then you calculate, and what you get here, we have also we neglect the centrifugal distortion, so then we get this expression. So the 4B0J plus 6B0. And now we think that the molecule is on the ground vibrational state. So this is expression for the transitions. And if we take into account the centrifugal distortion, again, you plug in this D term, and then this is what you get. And these expressions are obtained from this calculation. We calculate the 2F terms,
with 2 units difference in change. And then these are the transitions. So that now you would measure the spectrum, observe the peaks, and obtain from the peaks this expression, and you would understand the whole spectrum. Now we have this kind of labeling convention. So this is a spectrum, how the spectrum looks like. It is for nitrogen. And in the center here at the zero, we have a strong Rayleigh peak, and it is cut. So in reality, it's much, much higher, but we have cut it in order to see these two branches. And on the both sides, we have the rotational Raman peak. And we label these peaks so that according to delta J. So for example, delta J zero, so that is the Rayleigh peak, we call this Q branch. Then if delta J is plus one, we call it R branch. We don't have it here because we don't have plus one, but in absorption or emission we have. But delta J plus two is S branch. So we have S branch. And then on the other side, we have minus two, which is O branch. So in this way, we can label all each transition and start giving for example, in S branch, we have S, and then the index gives the lower starting level. So S zero, I think I wrote it. Yeah. So S zero corresponds to zero to two transition, for example, and S one would be 1 to 3. S two is 2 to 4. So it's the labeling convention. And then on the other side, O two is 2 to 0. We start from 2 because it's a, we cannot have the lowest transition is from 2 to 0 because we cannot go to minus one state. There is no such thing. So the first anti-Stokes starts from the JSQ level. So this is the labeling way. So now I can conveniently just my transition is S10, and then you know it's 10 to 12. But this is how the spectrum looks like. Now we already know that if you know the structure, you know the equilibrium distance of your molecules, you can calculate the spectrum. Or if you measure the spectrum, you can calculate the distance. So that means that from rotational spectrum, you can determine very accurate bond distance. So it is a structural method. Structural method for determination of equilibrium distance from moment of inertia. So basically from this equation, you measure your spectra, you assign your peaks, you calculate your rotational constant, and from which you calculate the moment of inertia, and then you can deduce the R. Now, if we have B0, so ground vibrational state, then we get R0, which is the bond distance at ground vibrational state. But if we have higher vibrational states, we can determine R for each vibrational state. Okay. Now, so that was about two diatomic molecules. When we go to polyatomic molecules, we have 3 moments of inertia. And it gets a bit more complicated. So we don't simply have just single stack of rotational level. We have quite complicated rotational spectrum. And we have to try to figure out, understand how these 3 rotational constants are there. So it is more complicated. So we will not go to that. But if you have to do it, then you go to this in more detail. Principles are the same, but it gets more complicated because we have 3 moments of inertia. It's not so simple anymore. Okay, so now we start the vibrational spectroscopy part. We will continue this vibrational spectroscopy part for a couple of lectures, but today we concentrate on gas-based vibrational spectroscopy. This is Hollar's chapter 6. And the point is that, in fact, we combine vibrational and rotational spectroscopy. Again, we start from diatomic molecules. And again, we have to understand the energy levels. And there, we have a good model, harmonic oscillator. And the energy level description is remarkably simple. So the energy levels for vibrational states, V are equal to H nu, this is the energy, times V plus half. So now, and where did we get this It is from a solution of Schrödinger equation for harmonic oscillator. Okay. From here, we can also determine so-called classical vibrational frequency of harmonic oscillator. With this expression here, which is a new, it's 1/2 pi, and then it's square root k per mu, where k is so-called force constant. So when we know the frequencies, we can determine so-called force constant. And this is a description of the bond strength. So if you determine the vibrational frequency from this expression, we can determine force constant. And the point is that these force constants are used, especially in older literature, as a way to compare the bond strengths of molecules. So here the unit is with strains at the joules per square angstrom, but the magnitude of these numbers immediately reflect the chemical structure. For example, HCl is 5.16, HF9, a bit stronger bond. But if you go to oxygen, which is a double bond, it's already 11. And if you go to nitrogen with a triple bond, it's 23. So we see that this force constant concept is quite useful in comparing the bond strength of molecules. Because usually the stronger the bond, the stiffer the vibration. Okay, so that is just good to know. But now we go into vibrational term values. So similarly to rotation, we give a label, and for vibrations, we give a label G. And our index is V, which is a vibrational quantum. So this gives us energies as a function of V. And now this is in dimensions of wave number. So we start from the energy description, which is in joules, and divide by HC, and then we get the wave number. Now we have a certain unfortunate coincidence here with it. Hollas' book, and in particular also many other books, use omega for wave number in vibrational spectroscopy. And it is unfortunate that it is also generally used for angular frequency. So this is unfortunate. But we just have to now accept that when we talk about vibrational spectroscopy, here we use omega for vibrational wave number. And that is not nice, but we just have to live with it. So anyway, now the energy levels are just simply V plus half times vibrational wave number, omega. Simple spectrum. What do we expect for the spectra? So next task was to determine the selection rule. Again, we start from transition moment, and either by considering symmetry properties or some other methods, we obtain selection rule delta V is plus minus one. This is very simple again. So the vibrational quantum number should change only by one unit. Here there is no simple way of understanding this, not like angular momentum for rotation. But there is a second selection rule that the derivative of the dipole moment must be non-zero. What does it mean? It means that when molecule has an equilibrium distance, it has a certain dipole moment, it can be zero. But when you stretch or compress the molecule, the dipole moment should change. So your molecule doesn't necessarily have to have a dipole moment, but it has to change when you stretch. And that makes sense again, because again, we have oscillating electric field, and that has to couple to oscillating dipole. And if your dipole moment changes when your molecule vibrates, then this changing, then it creates oscillating dipole, which couples to oscillating electric field. Okay. Now, okay, so that is infrared spectroscopy, absorption or emission. For Raman, we have the same selection rule for delta V, plus minus one, but we have the polarizability must change during vibrational modes. And the same argument again. We create induced dipole, and this induced dipole should change in vibration. And that changes if the polarizability changes during vibration. So this is again similar diagram for vibrational spectroscopy for Raman, that for the Rayleigh, we go up and down. So these are the two photons, ingoing and outgoing photon. And if we end up in the same vibrational state, it is a Rayleigh scattering. Or if we end up in an excited vibrational state, we talk about Stokes scattering. And if we end up from higher to lower state, we call it anti-Stokes. So what kind of spectra we expect to see? Now, we have to consider selection rules and thermal population. So again, if we have only, if the molecule is on the ground state, we expect to see only one transition from zero to one peak for each vibration, okay? And now vibrational energy spacings are much larger than rotational. So usually we don't have much population on the higher states, just the ground state. If we have heavy atoms or large molecules with the low frequency motion, we can have a little bit population on upper states. But for most of the time, we are usually on the ground vibrational state. So we would expect to see only one peak for each vibration. And that is the case, except that we have deviation because I already told you that real molecules are not harmonic oscillators, but they are unharmonic oscillators. And that unharmonicity causes also higher transitions, for example, 0 to 2, become allowed but weakly allowed. So they will be weak, much weaker than the ground, the 0 to 1 transition. So we expect to see one peak and maybe a little small peak for the 0 to 2 and higher transitions. So that is about unharmonicity. So this is a real true potential energy curve. And this is a harmonic oscillator. And you see that down here at the bottom, they fit very well. So they almost coincide. So harmonic oscillator describes very well these low states. So we have, it's pretty good selection rule here for lower states. But when you go to higher states, we start to deviate. And then we can have see these transitions, but they are very weak. So this unharmonicity breaks the selection rule and leads to this. But for most of the time, these are much weaker. So harmonic oscillator selection rule is very good approximation. And now we go to vibration rotation spectroscopy. So that means that in the same spectroscopic transition, both vibrational state and rotational state change. And that can certainly happen because we have rotational states associated with each vibrational state. So we kind of probe simultaneously both. And now we should consider total term values. Now we need S, symbol S, sum. Now it's a sum of G and F term values, vibration and rotation. So, and then we just write that this, the first term here is a vibrational energy level. Now we have omega E sub index. So this is a vibrational wave number times V plus half. And this plus and three dots plus means that in principle, there should be higher terms when we take into account unharmonicity, but we don't account them now. But this is a harmonic oscillator part. And then we have the rotational part. So this full expression now gives us all the possible levels, vibrational and rotational, vibration rotational levels. And selection rules, now we have to obey both, delta J is plus minus one, delta V is plus minus one, for absorption or emission. And now here are the transitions now. So, starting from the left, so this is absorption or emission. And now we have this, let's try to be clear. So you see that the, let's take branch C. So on P branch, we have delta J is minus one. So we start from the lower vibrational state from J is one, and we go to higher vibrational state, but J equals zero. Or we start from J2, and we go to J1, or start from J3 and go to J2, and so on. So, but simultaneously, we excite vibration. So we have this stack of levels regards the high vibrational states, and this stack of levels regards lower vibration. Or we have a rotation on the right. For example, in SO2 branch, we start from J2 and end up in J0 of other vibrational states. You see, we have this V prime prime for the lower symbol and V prime for the other. And on the left, we have a J point. So it just means that we have exactly the same kind of rotational transitions as before, but simultaneously we just excite the molecule vibration. All right. So this is how the spectrum looks like. This is for HCl, hydrogen chloride molecule, and this is absorption spectrum. And this is now in infrared region because this is vibration rotation spectroscopy. So we see that we have this envelope of transitions. This comes from rotational structure, population of rotational state. But the band center is at 2880 Quain number because this is a vibrational transition. Okay, and then the peaks correspond to rotational transitions in addition to this vibrational transition. If this was pure rotational spectrum, it would be from zero to maybe a few hundred Quain numbers. But now it's at almost at 3000 because we have vibrational transition and then rotational transition. Why there is hole here in the center, in the band center? Why there is no peak, but it's the largest space. You see that on the left we have R0, so that is J0 to J1 first. On the right we have first one is P1, so it's J1 to J0. So in the center, we should have which transition? What J levels should be there? J0 to 0 or 1 to 1, so delta J0. But you remember that it was not allowed. In absorption or emission, the selection rule is delta J is plus minus one. This is forbidden transition because angular momentum doesn't change, but we have photon angular momentum. So this is forbidden. That's why we don't have this. It's forbidden in absorption. We only see delta J plus one and minus one. That would be the position for Q branch. So now if we use the simple rigid rotor model, we don't have centrifugal distortion, and if we would assume that rotational constant is same at both higher and lower level, we can simply say that the spacing between level is 2b, and then we can deduce the center of the band as well. But we know that this is too simple. As you can see, if you go here on the right, the spacing between peaks is much higher than on the left. So that is because of centrifugal distortion and distance in equilibrium distance between vibration levels. So we have to take into account that, and we can take it into account, and we can analyze these four parameters, this vibrational level dependent rotational constant and the centrifugal distortion constant. Both can be analyzed, and we use this combination differences. I will tell you the principle, and there are a couple of formulas which the origin is clear. You just have to use them in exercise. So let's realize something, that Rj and Pj plus 1 have a common upper state. I will show you some. Let's see. Here. You see that if I take R0 transition, which means that it is the transition from J0, the lower vibrational state, to J1 on the upper state. And then I take P2, which starts from J2 of the lower vibrational state and ends up in J1 on the upper. You see that they have a common upper state. That means that if I take R0 and subtract P2 transition from that, the difference is equal to J0 to J2 energy difference, right? So if I just observe from the spectrum this R0, subtract wave number for P2 transition, and I get some number. And that is equal to J0 to J2 energy difference. And then if I use rigid rotor model, I can calculate B from the transition. Let's give it here. So basically it means that these transitions Rj minus Pj plus 2 is proportional to P prime prime. What does it mean? It's proportional to the lower vibrational state rotational constant, because it was energy different from the lower vibrational state, right? And then here are the formulas. So we just see the difference in these rotational levels. Here it's written in this way, that it's J minus 1, Rj minus 1, minus Pj plus 1. So this is the, for example, R0 minus P2. And we plug in these transition frequencies. You can go through this, but anyway, this is the result. So the difference is equal to 4 times B, now for the lower vibrational state, times J plus half. So that means that if you determine from a spectrum these two transitions, take their difference, then you can obtain B prime prime. That's how it goes. Now, similarly, if you take Rj and Pj, they have a common lower state. You see it from here. R1 is J1 to J2, and P1 is J1 to J0. So they have a common lower state, and their difference is equal to J0, J2 difference in the upper vibrational state. And again, you do the algebra, and exactly equivalent expression, but now you get the upper vibrational state rotational constant. So in this method, from the spectrum, if you can assign your peaks, you can determine the rotational constants for upper and lower vibrational state. And the band center can be determined also. Now, the same goes for Raman spectra. Now I go just quickly through. Principle is exactly the same. It's just because of the delta J is 2, we have different levels, but I just give the result and you can look in more detail. This is how the Raman spectrum looks like. Now we have a Q branch. You remember we have delta J 0 allowed. So we have the Q branch and we have the S branch, we have the O branch. And again, now I go quickly, but the principle is the same. You just have to put the formulas, and formula gives you that the difference between S J minus 1 and O J plus 2, so now 4 J quantum number difference is equal to 8 times P prime prime J plus half. And for the SJOJ, it means 8 times the upper state. So from both from Raman and Ilpert, you can determine these parameters. Okay, so that's all for the theory part. And that allows you to understand vibration rotation spectra and rotation spectra, and you know how to determine the structure of molecules, but now I just in the end give you some applications. So technical and industrial applications of gas phase spectroscopy, all of these examples are Finnish inventions and Finnish companies. First one is Gasmet. There is a company called Gasmet Technologies based in Helsinki, and they develop and manufacture gas analyzers based on infrared absorption spectroscopy. And it is a multi-component analysis, so it analyzes simultaneously several gas components. So you can have a gas mixture, and it gives you all the concentrations of the mixture. It is based on measuring the full spectrum and gas phase spectrum, and in the gas spectra, if you the spectrum is the sum of spectra of individual components, and it is based on measuring the component spectra as pure gases and then having them as a library, and it fits the full spectrum in terms of library spectra and tries to fit it optimally so that no residual is there, and then you can determine the gas concentrations. And it is quite successful company, so they are selling a lot of these instruments all over the world. And I was involved in the early stages of the development, so I made the first spectrum library for this instrument a long time ago, maybe more than 20 years ago. And just by, as a summer job, I was in the lab taking different gases and measuring and making a pressure measuring system and determining various gases. And now it's they need understanding of infrared spectroscopy and gas phase spectroscopy for development. And it is in particular, it's based on low resolution SPR. So you don't have to resolve all the peaks accurately. These are examples. So this is the library spectrum for hydrogen chloride, partially resolved vibration rotation peaks. This is a library spectrum for hydrogen cyanide. This structure comes from the P and R branches. So there is rotational structure, but it's not resolved. So all the rotational peaks are coalesced. There is not enough resolution, but it comes from a rotational structure. But these are the library spectra, and then the full spectrum is formed as a combination of these. Next one is a gas glass insulation glass pane analyzer. So these windows, nowadays they are filled with argon gas to improve thermal insulation and sound insulation and durability of the glass. So this instrument can measure the content of argon through the glass without breaking the glass. So quantitative, how much argon there is. Because it's important that argon stays there, there is a leak. So I was also, so this is, it's a company called Sparklight Limited. And this is based on an invention we did in Helsinki University, also more than 20 years ago. And it is based on electrical discharge induced with a high frequency, high voltage spark. So it makes a small spark inside the gas discharge and measures the spectrum of emitted lines. And it can measure quantitatively argon gas. And then Gasera, high sensitivity gas analysis. This is a Turku-based company. And it is also infrared spectroscopy, but they have an innovation where the detector is very sensitive. It is so-called photoacoustic detector. It's based on this principle here, where there is a light beam, which is chopped. So it's modulated with some kind of a chopper, and the beam goes in the cuvette. And when we chop the light beam, it creates acoustic wave here. If you go to acoustic frequency, chopping frequency, modulated frequency, and you have basically very sensitive microphones detects the acoustic signal, and this acoustic signal is now detected. And that is very sensitive. So they developed this sensitive gas analysis techniques. They have two different techniques. One is based on a FTIR, broad spectrum, or single line detection via tunable laser absorption. And they aim at very high sensitivity applications. It turns out that if in gas analysis, you can go to really high sensitivity, you can do very interesting things, like go to harbor and sniff from the containers if there is some illegal substance or whatever. So, for example, so it's very, very many applications arise if you go, if you reach high sensitivity below PPM level. So. Then Vaisala is the world leader in atmospheric measurements, and they have gas analyzers, which are very compact. They measure, for example, carbon dioxide concentration or water vapor concentration, also other gases. And it's based on this kind of principle. You have this module, and you have a light source and a mirror and a detector in a very compact configuration. And you basically have filters which isolate only single vibration rotation line. So, for example, from a carbon dioxide spectrum, you measure only one single vibration rotation line, and that's intensity, and that tells you the concentration of the gas. So they are very compact and low cost. And here is the one single vibration rotation line. And this is our own invention. We have developed this kind of multi-gas analyzer based on rotational Raman. So we have built a prototype. And the benefit of that is that it can measure, again, through sealed container, and it can measure gases, which STR cannot measure, like nitrogen and oxygen. They are not infrared active. So, but this Raman technique can measure, these are all spectra measured with this instrument, and it can determine quantitatively these gases. And originally we had an application in mind, which is food industry. We actually were in a food processing plant measuring this modified atmosphere packaging. So we can basically measure through the package the composition of the gas. And it was very interesting, and we had very good results. But at that time, it turned out to be maybe a bit too expensive for that, because it was very rare that there was any problem. So, but if you go to the supermarket, you buy these packages, and you have one which is kind of, you know, very overpressurized or very flat, which one you take?
Well, it's flat.
Yeah, I take the other one. It's because the one which is overpressurized is sealed, but the one which is flat, there can be a small hole, so the gas leaks out. If it, people tend to think that there is some kind of microbial process which puts gas in, but it means that it's properly sealed. It has not leaked, but the flat may have leaked. But very seldom there is any problem. But we recognize there are variations in this atmospheric package. But this is, of course, very common nowadays. So very many food stuffs, they are in modified atmospheres nowadays. And this method can measure them. But the commercialization was not successful yet, but there is actually mostly due to price, I think. But now there is a lot of demand for this instrument in photocatalytic studies, investigation. So where people develop photocatalysts for hydrogen production of water, for example. And this can measure in situ in sealed ampoule hydrogen production. So we have delivered two instruments to Sweden and Germany based on a mutual contract with this. So maybe there is still space for this. Thank you. So that's all.
Yeah.